You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Charlie XCX on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Now here's the editor's letter from Mark Guiducci, with photograph by Aidan Zamiri. I first met Charlie XCX in May 2024 when we co-hosted a party in New York's Floral District ahead of a new album launching the following month. Charlie booked a DJ I'd never heard of, who called himself The Dare, and despite a dress code that suggested florals, she wore head-to-toe black. Everyone exited the party with armfuls of peonies, tulips, cherry blossoms, and ranunculus, but nobody, not even Charlie herself, could have left with an understanding of what that summer had in store for her. 18 months later, we know that Brat was less an album than an organism, an artistic edifice that built on itself over and over, with continuous remix releases up through a fateful weekend in July 2024, when it reached the presidential election. Kamala Harris was Brat, until she wasn't. Like a Marvel franchise, it wasn't until Brat Summer entered its second year that Charlie herself brought the era to a close, stripping it all down into an arena tour that starred her utterly alone on stage. No band, no dancers, no backup singers. Inhaling, exhaling, and literally licking up the cultural power of the phenomenon she had conjured. So, what does a brat grow up to be? A newlywed and a movie star so far, with no fewer than 7 film projects and 1 new husband, Charlie has officially started writing her next chapter, and we are thrilled to capture her in that moment. Speaking of cultural phenomena, the week before I started at Vanity Fair, Soren Mamdani, at age 33, won the Democratic nomination in the race for New York City mayor. If he wins in November, he will be the first avowedly Democratic socialist in the job, and the first Muslim. Reactions, ranging from jubilation in Dimes Square to fear and loathing in the Hamptons, were as expected, except on the very far right. Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene each praised Mamdani, if for only a fleeting moment, regarding his victory as a blow to establishment elites. The Georgia congresswoman also posted on X a picture of the Statue of Liberty wearing a burqa, ensuring that Islamophobia overshadowed any more nuanced stance. What everyone could agree upon with certainty is that Mamdani's ascendance has been fascinating and important. This month, as the general election approaches, special correspondent James Pogue brings us a profile of Mamdani, Captain America, that is as expansive in its approach as it is incisive in its personal details. James spent several days hitting the sidewalks with Mamdani, a candidate so peripatetic he is sometimes literally running for mayor, to discover that his similarities to JFK do not end at youth and mediagenic star quality. Like our first Irish Catholic president, James writes, Mamdani has the ability to find voters in a block of poor immigrants whose values and religion had long been seen as dangerous, alien, and simply un-American. Let it be said that in 2025, it's shocking what values do and do not pass for American. Thank you. Now for the contributors to the issue, Aidan Zamiri, Brat's Next Act. I hope I get to make stuff with Charlie for the rest of my life, says photographer and director Zamiri, who first began working with the pop star in 2023 and directed her in their upcoming A24 film, The Moment. She's one of the most important artists of our time, and I'm constantly in awe of her. Shooting this story together felt really special, like a milestone in this creative relationship we've built together. Taryn Simon, The Last Stand, using photography, sculpture, text, sound, and performance, Simon's art centers on storytelling, secrecy, and the hidden contours of power. For this issue, she photographed the artist Richard Prince at his home on the east end of Long Island. Simon, whose work is in the collections of the Guggenheim, Tate Modern, the Pompidou Center, and others, first met Prince early in her career. Nate Freeman, The Last Stand, State of the Art. Culture correspondent Freeman spent a long morning in the Hamptons with Richard Prince for the artist's first interview in more than a decade. Freeman also helped oversee the issue's expansive list of tomorrow's art stars, featuring 33 artists poised to dominate evening auctions and museum walls in the years to come. He and his wife, Lucy, recently welcomed their second child. Sina Nasseri, Captain America. Nasseri learned photography after leaving a career in law. He described his day on the campaign trail with New York mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani as a whirlwind. One minute he was mobbed by crowds asking for pictures, where I heard shouts of "he's attractive" and "communist." Later, as a summer storm approached, he had lunch at a Queens kebab house with AOC and Bernie. Evgenia Peretz, broken-hearted. Peretz says it was fascinating to examine the explosion of the partnership between Barbara Guggenheim and Abigail Asher, who were like family to each other and whose firm had been a respected bedrock of the art advising business. The saga points at the pitfalls of an industry that's been historically, and rather proudly, guided by trust, to the exclusion of regulation and contracts, the writer says. Jeff Henriksen, State of the Art. Henriksen, whose work focuses on portraiture in the eclectic worlds of art, fashion, and music, traveled to London, Paris, Los Angeles, and upstate New York to photograph each of the artists featured in the State of the Art portfolio. I love the act of creating a photograph, but the conversation and time spent with each person is a large part of why I cherish what I do, he says. Daniela Tirina reports behind the issue. In the photos, pop art, Charlie 2 by E.C. Wood. Wood, photographed by Jeff Henriksen in her London studio, holds a Bachelor of Arts from Goldsmiths and a Master of Arts from the Royal Academy Schools. It's been nearly 20 years since Vanity Fair presented an art-themed issue. That one came with Brad Pitt on the cover and one of Robert Wilson's life-size video portraits. The magazine's return to the form was to feature the indomitable, undefinable musician Charlie XCX on its cover. The first and only pick to make art out of Charlie was E.C. Wood, an equally thrilling London-based painter and musician herself. Wood has risen to prominence, painting the quotidian elements that punctuate the day-to-day IRL and scrolling milieu of someone like Charlie. Leather car interiors, puffy jackets, homeware accoutrement, jewelry, pets, and other elements that orbit the Brat universe. Wood, who currently has a solo show at the Schinkel Pavilion in Berlin, agreed to the assignment, painting an original of Charlie for a limited edition run of issues to complement photographer Aidan Zamiri's cover shoot. She hit the ground running, producing four different paintings. I was a tragic overachiever at school and always did my homework the night it was set, says Wood. The chosen work, painted on orange velvet, details Charlie's face and trademark brows, with Wood's flourishes of white swoops and golden stars falling down the canvas. It's clearly Charlie and clearly Issy. Wood admits that it would have never occurred to her to paint somebody like Charlie without Vanity Fair initiating it. The famous women I've painted in the past are in a different aesthetic category, she says, which is a polite way of saying they have had a lot of plastic surgery. Wood was inspired to peer at Charlie through her own lens, pulling inspiration from things like the length and quality of her career prior to the global success of Brat, the throwaway candor of her lyrics, the Britishness we both share, she says. She knew that the task at hand, painting one of the most recognizable pop stars in the world, would be a challenge. Possibly made more complex as Charlie sheds her bright green Brat persona to try her hand at acting in movies. If the result resembles the genre of fan art, Wood says, I'm okay with that, because fan art is one of the purest and most tender art forms we have. Odessa Azion, the emblematic Gen Z cool girl, seems poised to become a reluctant celebrity, which made her perfect for director Josh Safdie's latest film, Marty Supreme. By Savannah Walsh, with photographs by Tierney Giron. In the photos, Wild Wild West, Odessa Azion photographed on August 7th in Malibu, California. Odessa Azion has a date with Quentin Tarantino. She's planning to see Reservoir Dogs at the New Beverly Cinema, which the filmmaker bought in 2007. But first, Azion must get through her first Vanity Fair photo shoot. Posing is anxiety-inducing enough, even without a long drive up a windy Malibu hill that's left Azion carsick. But she puts the nausea aside once she reaches the beach, chugging water before launching herself into crashing waves, nerves momentarily forgotten. Azion should get used to just diving in. The 25-year-old, makeup-free and dressed in a striped shirt for our interview, her mop of curly hair, now dry, has graduated from playing troubled teens on short-lived series like Netflix's Grand Army and the CBS sitcom Fam to It Girl in Waiting status. This fall, she'll become the face of a generation in two titles, I Love L.A., a comedy series from Rachel Sennett that airs Sunday nights on HBO, and Josh Safdie's A24 sports drama Marty Supreme, starring Timothée Chalamet as the titular table tennis champion. Uncomfortable as the attention may feel, God, interviews are so weird, she rasped, Azion certainly looks the part. She's got a trendy septum piercing and a smattering of tattoos, frequently on display in the Instagrams she posts with friends like Madeline Klein and Billie Eilish. Azion is a romantic, says Safdie. She's also a punk. It's an overwhelming moment, but one Azion has been building toward since childhood. At 8, she was reciting movie scenes to her bathroom mirror. As a teenager, she attended Champs Charter High School of the Arts in Van Nuys, California, though she spent only a few weeks in its theater program. I hated it so much, says Azion. At 15, she began a frustrating 2 years of fruitless auditioning. I was fully convinced I'm never going to book anything ever, Azion says. To put it more frankly, as she tends to do, I must suck balls. The tide began to turn when Azion ditched the neutral outfits she'd been advised to wear and embraced her own instincts. I started not giving an F, she says. Then things started happening. She booked a role on the musical drama Nashville, then played supporting parts in indies like Am I OK? And The Final Girl in 2022's Hellraiser reboot. Not that Azion is eager to revisit these credits. I've hated every single performance of mine, she says. If you're a painter and don't want to show your early work, you don't have to. When you're acting, things that you would now call mistakes still exist in the world. This coming-of-age period is around the time when Azion decided to drop her given surname, which perhaps could have opened a few more doors. She's a daughter of actor Pamela Adlon and German writer-producer Felix Adlon. Both of her grandfathers were filmmakers. Her older sister, Gideon, is also an actor. Their childhood loosely inspired Pamela's critically acclaimed FX series Better Things, about a single working mother raising three girls in L.A. Azion played a character named Defiance in its first season. Perhaps a nod to her desire to be known as more than somebody's kid. When asked about distancing herself from the Adlon name, Azion is guarded but firm. It was important to me to... It's just my name now. It's my own name. It carried Azion through what she considers her first adult role, as a woman diagnosed with terminal cancer in the 2023 dramedy Sitting in Bars with Cake. The film came after Azion made three TV flops in a row, a running joke on the set of I Love L.A. Guys, clearly I'm the bad luck charm, as Zion would say between takes, so if we don't go past season one, I'm so sorry. But hopes are high for the series. A natural successor to Lena Dunham's Girls and Issa Rae's Insecure, Zion plays Tallulah, an influencer with a devil-may-care attitude whose most viral stunt involved riding the New York City subway in a bikini during the pandemic. Tallulah shows up in Los Feliz unannounced, scantily clad, and ready to make her mark. In the pilot, she flashes one of the Church of Scientology's Hollywood buildings. I Love L.A. was a lot harder for me than anything I've ever done because me and the character are so different, says Zion. I don't wear clothes like that. Power to the people who can, and I definitely felt that she helped me gain confidence, but it still was really difficult. And acting so two-faced, she's so effing hyper-confident and a little bit of a narcissist. Zion's I Love L.A. co-stars, Sinnott, Josh Hutcherson, Jordan Firstman, and True Whitaker, daughter of Forrest, helped her feel comfortable on set and in photo shoots, which she finds as awkward as interviews. Her close friend and fellow actor Drew Starkey accompanied Zion to her Vanity Fair shoot's rural location. There, he rolled up his sleeves and agreed to help photographer Tierney Giron by holding mirrors and talking Zion through setups. At multiple points, Giron handed the camera over to Starkey so he could try his hand at taking her picture. After Zion auditioned for I Love L.A. and met with Safdie over Zoom for Marty Supreme, she was initially told she'd lost both parts. I was like, well, I'll just go F myself, she says. Then her fortunes changed, much like real-life ping-pong star Marty Reisman, who inspired Chalamet's character in the film. Zion plays Rachel, his complicated love interest. The character is a dreamer, and Zion is too. She's got a feeble Moskowitz quality, says Safdie, comparing the actor to the adorable hero of the 1986 animated film An American Tale. Feivel Moskowitz. She feels independent, but also dead set on finding a way home. Chalamet's immersive acting method motivated Zion. He takes it very seriously. I get embarrassed when I feel like somebody's looking at me, getting in my process, she says. I'm working on removing the fear of judgment. Honestly, Nike got it right, because it's true. You just have to do it. And I think Timothy does. Zion is thrilled to finally have more visible projects, partly for practical reasons. I still need the money, she says. You'd be surprised. You do these big movies, but you're not getting a giant effing paycheck. I definitely would like to cash another check, so I don't have to be evicted from my apartment. Above all, Zion is interested in making the kinds of films her generation will want to see in person in either New York or L.A. I love both, she says. If I could break down the wall between them and just have it be like an open giant window, I would. And don't get the wrong idea. She has an artistic wish list, too. Quentin Tarantino, if you're reading this, I'm here. Put me in the last movie, please. I'll do anything. Dreamweaver by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Sharon Radish. For his debut at Dior, Jonathan Anderson worked with prolific textile artist Sheila Hicks to reimagine the house's epochal Lady Dior bag with texture, utility, movement, and fun. The bags, which were shown draped over shoulders or tucked under arms, their tassel details bouncing down the runway, and pictured here, signal that Anderson's love of craft and collaboration continue beyond his tenure at Louis and onto his mantle at Dior. Hicks has long been a font of inspiration for the fashion world, a fact that she's well aware of. "Every year there's one of them," she once told the New Yorker, of designers who cite her. Anderson, whom Hicks describes as an art enthusiast and collector, was ultimately drawn to Hicks's ponytail motif, one she first exhibited in 1969. Over the course of 3 months, the pair refined the arrangement and integration of the ponytails into the Lady Dior, even rethinking its interior. Reflecting Sheila's attention to both aesthetics and function, Anderson said, "How does this relate to Hicks's work at large?" "It's inextricably linked," she said. "The result is a creation emblematic of the shared values between Dior and Hicks, which are, according to Anderson, a deep curiosity for material and form, a reverence for craftsmanship, and an avant-garde spirit grounded in historical knowledge." Connecting threads. 1928, Christian Dior co-founds an art gallery that displays works by Picasso. 1947, Dior holds his first fashion show in Paris. 1957, Sheila Hicks receives her BFA from Yale and a Fulbright grant to study ancient Andean weaving. 1958, after Dior's death, Yves Saint Laurent shows his first collection as creative director. 1960, MoMA is the first museum to acquire one of Hicks's works. 1984, Jonathan Anderson is born in Northern Ireland. 1995, French First Lady Bernadette Chirac gifts Princess Diana an unreleased Dior Chouchou bag. She carries it so often, Dior renames it Lady Dior after her. 2005, Anderson graduates from the London College of Fashion. 2008, Anderson launches J.W. Anderson and begins his art collection with a John Ward piece. 2010, Sheila Hicks, 50 Years, a retrospective, opens at the Addison Gallery of American Art. 2013, Louis hires Anderson as creative director. 2017, Anderson inaugurates the Louis Craft Prize. 2022, Hicks receives the Legion d'Honneur. 2025, Anderson is appointed the first creative director of men's, women's, and couture at Dior since Christian Dior himself. 2025, Anderson and Hicks collaborate on this purse, featured in his debut show. Nate Freeman gives us a studio visit, muse and maker. The painter Kate Capshaw, known for her intimate likenesses, could hardly say no when the National Portrait Gallery commissioned one of Steven Spielberg, her husband of more than 30 years. In the photo, Marriage of Minds, Kate Capshaw in her studio with her portrait of Steven Spielberg, the picture maker. In 2016, 7 years after beginning her visual art studies, Kate Capshaw began working with youth organizations to paint the portraits of unhoused young people. She arrived at shelters with food and water, listening to them describe their lives as she worked. The resulting series, Unaccompanied, hung at the Hope Center in Los Angeles. At the National Portrait Gallery, director Kim Saget and curator Dorothy Moss took notice. She reportedly urged Capshaw to apply for a portraiture award, and after she placed as a finalist, the NPG temporarily hosted three works from Unaccompanied. In May, amid sweeping changes to the Smithsonian, which houses the NPG, President Trump posted to social media that he was terminating Saget's employment due to, he claimed, her support of DEI. Saget stepped down from her position in June. 3 years ago, when it came time to commission a portrait of filmmaker Steven Spielberg for the NPG, Capshaw was an obvious choice. Yes, she had an undeniable knack for portraiture, but Capshaw also had special insight into the director of Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, and Jaws. Before she was an artist, Capshaw had acted in Spielberg's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. They have also been married for more than 3 decades. I was very moved, Capshaw says. When I meet her this summer, I felt the honor. I felt the heft. I know this man, and I know how large he is, and I also know how very intimate he is. She set out to capture Spielberg the person rather than Spielberg the phenomenon. Instead of leaning into the iconic image of Spielberg as a swashbuckling New Hollywood icon or a box office slaying hero, she opted for her signature black background and used as the source material an image of a softly smiling Stephen at their breakfast nook. Stephen, the partner with whom she's raised multiple kids, made a life. I wasn't going to put a camera in the portrait, and I wasn't going to put him on a director's chair, and he wasn't going to wear a baseball cap, she says. I wasn't going to have E.T. flying in. And yet, the portrait had to somehow convey her husband's monumental contribution to American culture. Then, eureka, she could project her husband's work directly onto the canvas. And not say, Leo and Catch Me If You Can. She wanted clips that were personal, so she asked her husband if she could root through the never-before-seen early work that the budding auteur shot when he was a precocious teenager. It was like I had just found the amber in Jurassic Park, and I realized there was DNA in it, she says. I discovered that there were archival films from when he was 18. Come on, treasure chest. For film nerds, this is a revelation. There's even footage from his legendary lost sci-fi film Firelight. Capshaw uses a scene that Spielberg copied in his autobiographical film The Fablemans. Watching the proto-Spielberg artifacts, it's shocking how the filmmaker prefigures his mature masterpieces. Sugarland is there, Indiana Jones is there, West Side Story is there, Capshaw says. All of the war movies are there. After Spielberg is honored at the Portrait of a Nation Gala in November, the work will enter the permanent collection, complete with the film projection. I was given the task of painting a portrait of this man who I couldn't love more, but it was going into an institution that would own it forever, she says. I'd been given this story to write. I'd better damn well write it great. Now this from Byron Hudayer. We nominate for Oblivion Orange Wine. In a revival of a Jazz Age Vanity Fair column, one writer explores how a modest experiment in winemaking has fermented into a nightmare. Orange wine enthusiast will tell you it harks back to ancient Georgia, to wine aged and buried kaveri and liberated from modern interference. Archaic methods, the thrill of the authentic for a wine more alive and expressive, a purer conduit for terroir and truth. What began as an earnest flirtation with low-intervention winemaking has curdled into something faintly cultish. Oxidized, seditious liquids sloshed from reclaimed carafes in Bushwick, Kreuzberg, or in Hackney, praised in reverent tones by men in harem pants and cycling caps. Against better judgment, I have tried these orange wines, egged on by sommelier with the sort of facial hair that suggests either deep conviction or an elaborate dare. These wines appear smugly on menus alongside foraged disappointment served on filament-lit sharing plates. Cider aged in a dried boot, redolent of barnyard regret. Orange wine is a low sulfite con, a prolonged student prank passed off as enlightenment. And like many student pranks, it smells of manure and failure. There is a juvenile glee in rejecting filtration, stability, or even consistency as moral virtues. Murkiness isn't a feature, it's a flaw. This is not progress. It is a collapsed scaffolding of taste. Real wine is civilization bottled, transfigured by soil, sunlight, and savoir-faire into a triumph of memory over impulse. One of the few things humanity has tangibly improved upon with age, error, and the exquisite tyranny of tradition. Real wine is the triumph of method over mayhem. Under the stewardship of monks, vintners, and noble hoarders, craft becomes culture. Natural wine's unpredictability fatally obliterates one of wine's most important uses. It acts in concert with food. A great bottle can solo, but it harmonizes best in symphony as part of an orchestra. Orange wine does not reliably present as red or white, nor as light or full-bodied. It is a roulette wheel of tannin and acidity. A zealot wine bar will persist in a charade of specificity, stage whispering elaborate tasting notes and rules about pairing, when in truth the outcome is a potshot. By contrast, in the high temples of good wine, like Le Bon Georges in the ninth arrondissement, the sommelier never misses. Every bottle earns its place. Here, nuance and humility reign. The wine list is longer than a glam rocker's mercifully shelved erotic memoirs, and its vintage likely more appropriate. Quality rules here. Sometimes this includes orange wine, but it is offered in context, not blind zeal. So the next time someone pours you something that smells like silage and insists it's alive, feel free to agree and banish it to oblivion. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.